Welcome to the CDH Conversations podcast. Today, we are joined by Salomo Hay from High Economic Intelligence, an economist holding a master's degree, and Mercy Kudeko, CDH's director, holding a master's degree in taxation. Welcome to CDH Conversations podcast, Mercy and Salomo.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Patrick. Thank you for having me. Hi, everyone.
We are indebted to both of you joining in discussing the recently tabled budget statement by the Minister of Finance. And we will start with Mr. Hay to give us an overview of the fiscal policy that defines the budget from a revenue expenditure perspective.
Thank you. So essentially, I'm just going to backtrack a bit. What are the principles or the fundamentals that the Honorable Minister spoke to when she tabled the budget? She had what we now refer to as the three P's, which is productivity. Productivity in the sense that you want to see a productive Namibian economy. And then she made reference to the people, which essentially is the contract that the budget has with the Namibian people to be able to make sure it's perhaps one of the single most important tools that bridge social inequalities because of the ability of government to be able to open up the safety net. And then the third one she referred to was the prudence. Now, historically, you would remember that you would either have what they call the fiscal expansion, where government tend to spend and really want to breathe some economic activity through the budget expansionary policy. So it would be spending more on your development budget. It would be deliberate in perhaps infrastructure that will then propel economic activity. And then over time, if your expansionary policy do not yield what you have perceived to want to achieve, it would mean that in all likelihood, you tend to take debt as a basis to fund that expansionary policy. Now, if debt remains higher for longer, it means that you can no longer continue on your expansionary route. You would then have to consider what you would refer to as fiscal consolidation to be able to bring your debt under control. So this is where the fiscal prudence come from. And from a revenue perspective, in terms of answering your question, if you remember at the last budget, which was the 2025-2026, revenue to be collected was projected, has come in much lower than what was projected at that point. And obviously, there are different reasons why that has happened. One that the revenue agency themselves has admitted to was the refund that they paid out to businesses and SMEs. And subsequently, it meant that their revenue collection or their revenue base declined. Obviously, you'd also remember there was the tax thresholds that was moved up in terms of the taxable individuals or taxpayers, if it were. So it means that also a portion of those previously individuals have now moved out of that. And then generally, the whole unemployment problem that we don't have a lot of people paying tax, but it appears that we are absorbing quite a huge number of them on the welfare side, which is not necessarily what one would want to see. But over and above that expenditure, now from the expenditure side, you see that again, the social cluster almost got over 60% of total appropriation, which essentially is quite a huge number. And again, to my previous point, that you would rather want to have more people entering the tax base as opposed to more people on welfare. There has been the conversation that the bulk of the budget goes to the operational expenses, which is correct or which is true. But remember that operational expenses take into account salaries. And salaries, in my view, at times can be construed as investment in personnel cost. So what you want to see is this return on investment from the budget perspective towards the civil service. So one would want to see efficiencies coming through. And on top of that, the budget also spoke to a 5% increase on the salaries of the civil servants. Now, if you look at what the inflation rate currently is, you realize that that 5% is actually above inflation. So that's really more on the expenditure side. If you look at the debt servicing cost or interest payments, if it were, again, that's much higher. I think it's just around 14 or 16 billion, which is much higher than the development budget or the CapEx budget, if it were. So remember what we spoke about in terms of government using this opportunity at times to really breathe life into the economy by using the development budget. This time it appears that there has been prioritization and there are certain areas that did not execute the previous development budget. So what that means is that if your execution rate is low, it makes it extremely difficult to justify why the development budget should be increased. But the reality is that you want to deal with why the execution rate is low, because at the end of the day, it means that you're not doing a service or you're doing a disservice to the actual budget intent and objective. I can also speak about the debt issue. The fiscal prudence obviously comes on the back of our debt having grown very quickly over a certain period of time. And what that means is that our debt is staying higher for longer. Now, subject to who you speak to, different economists have got different views on this. I'm always of the view that it's not always so much the size of debt. It's really got to do with the direction of debt. When I say direction of debt, I mean, where is debt going to? Is debt that government takes on going to the productive side, or is it perhaps being absorbed into inefficiencies and leakages? So if that happens, then obviously you would have a problem bringing the debt quickly under control. So the size of the debt obviously plays a role, but I think what's more important is really the direction. Where is debt flowing towards within the government coffers?
Thanks for that overview, Mr. Hay. On the tech side, Ms. Kudeko, would you please take us through corporate tax? It looks like it is progressively coming down. Is that to the benefit of corporate Namibia?
Yes and no, I would say. I mean, the tax rate for non-mining companies have been reducing since 2024 from what was then 32%. And it's projected to, at least once the income tax amendment bill is passed through parliament, to then be reduced further to 28%. But what that same bill also proposed, which might actually have counter effects to that very reduction, is that it intends to firstly introduce a dividend tax to residents in Namibia. Currently, dividends is not taxed in Namibian residents or resident companies, but that act would then introduce a dividend tax, which obviously would sort of also counter the effect of having reduced the tax rate to 28%. What it does, however, also propose to introduce is what would be known as a small and medium businesses, and that will enjoy a special regime, provided, of course, you qualify as a small and medium business. And that currently it's proposed any business that has a turnover that doesn't exceed more than 10 million. So those businesses would be taxed at a further reduced corporate tax rate of 20%. So for those qualifying small and medium businesses, they would be taxed at 20%. But importantly, they would actually also be exempt from this proposed new dividend tax up to 100,000. So for those businesses, they would at least enjoy a buffer that the rest of corporate Namibia might not necessarily enjoy. That would possibly be one of the biggest corporate change that is proposed through the budget. But there are a few introductions that the minister alluded to when it comes to group tax relief with respect to property owning companies. We do not at the moment know what those relief would be and how group companies would be defined, but it is welcomed because at least it would allow within group structures for assets to be moved around without really triggering tax consequences. I think those possibly would be the first two of the most prominent corporate introductions or proposals that are intended to be introduced by the bill. But also, the bill introduces a comprehensive anti-avoidance regime for hybrid financial instruments, your debt disguised as equity. The proposal currently is that if a debt falls within a hybrid equity instrument definition, then any of those distributions would actually be taxed as income and not as dividend. This, of course, would have implications for structured finances and group funding arrangements that are currently in place and where preference shares or any of those third-party backed shares are issued, and we'll have to see how exactly and in what format the act will actually be formulated.
Very well. I am now going to ask both of you a vexed question. The previous budgets were said to be pro-poor, pro-growth, and aimed at fiscal consolidation. Compared to the current budget, what would you say is the aim of the current budget? We start with you, Mr. Hay, and then after Ms. Kudeko.
No, thank you. I think I sort of foreshadowed what underpins this particular budget. Obviously, one of the underlining things that you keep seeing in the productivity side, which essentially would be the growth side that the minister alluded to, is if you look at the revenue, the growth in the non-tax revenue is much higher than the tax revenue, not in terms of quantum, but in terms of the growth rate. So what you realize is that there's now a move towards looking at optimizing and bringing about efficiencies within state-owned enterprise, because I think there is a growth policy within the SOE. Now, if you look at the last financial year, there has been an increase in the SOE's dividend payover to the shareholder, which essentially is a Namibian government. So the reality is that if that underpins growth, it means that the SOEs needs to build efficiency, they need to become more competitive, and they need to be strengthened in terms of their strategic outlook, which then will be accompanied by enhanced corporate governance and the like. So there are different tiers of SOEs in Namibia in terms of those that are tiered to be economic SOEs. Economic in the sense that there's an obligation on them to have a return on the shareholder. MTC is one of those, the mobile telecommunication, and Namport is one of those. There are others, obviously, that are also doing very well, like the road fund administration in terms of the collection of the fuel levies. So that's the growth side. I mean, we are again seeing that there is what Mercy spoke to in terms of the special economic zone, essentially where you would want to see SMEs being incubated, if it were, in that zone, to be able to enjoy a preferential tax rate in relation to your normal tax. And that could mean that perhaps you could then move the needle in terms of expanding your secondary sector. Because essentially within the secondary sector is where the job absorption capacity is much higher. And this is where you ideally would want to move into beneficiation and value addition. One of the other things that one has to applaud, if it were, a comment where she said that investors and everyone that's looking at Namibia want to have policy certainty. And as part of that policy certainty, they would then want to see the investment promotion and facilitation bill being enacted, because that essentially sets the tone for perhaps what could be our biggest sector, which is the oil and gas. So within that particular piece of legislation, you would want to find the clarity around the Namibianization of subsectors or what the thinking is. So I think that bill is currently before, and I could be speaking under correction in terms of where it is, but the reality is that you want to have those pieces of legislation come through so that when the FID is made by the oil majors, everyone understands what they are signing up for, and subsequently one is able to have a level of some understanding of what would accrue to what the local content is. So in relation to the previous budgets, I think the room for one fiscal expansion was simply not there. And also you pick up that there's now fiscal prudence, which essentially means that you have to prioritize given the pressing priorities as a consequence of your revenue base. Looking forward, it appears as if the SACU revenues will definitely boost us again in the next financial year. And that could potentially mean that our projected revenue is much higher than what it is now. Now, there's a big move towards dealing with high youth unemployment. There was the youth fund that's currently being rolled out, and the minister reported on the success of that. Because obviously the youth is the biggest population group, but they also have the biggest unemployed numbers. So the youth initiatives and the youth empowerments, I think just below 300 million, which intend to expand the youth enterprise financing through the development fund. Again, there was a feedback report on what has been rolled out to date, which gave us a good sense of the huge appetite there is for young people to engage in economic activity. So you want to see those initiatives take root. You want those initiatives being accelerated. Obviously, through that, you would then move towards bringing down the stubborn youth unemployment. So there's definitely pockets of growth being initiated, especially given the extremely stringent revenue cycle and perhaps limited fiscal space the Treasury has.
Thanks, Mr. Hay. Mercy, maybe if you could elaborate a bit on that, if it were, but of course, maybe with a bit of emphasis on EPZs. Are they dead? What do we make of the minister's speech in relation to EPZs?
The death of the EPZ does not come about because of the current budget speech. It was introduced into the Income Tax Act by Section 101A, which repealed the provisions of the Export Processing Zones Act, specifically Sections 5, 6, and 7, sub 2 of that Act. Those sections gave preference to EBZ companies and allowed them, for example, they didn't have to pay transfer duties, nor did they have to pay stamp duties or income tax. With the repeal of those sections, it means effective from the 1st of January 2026, those companies no longer enjoy that preferential treatment. And with the special economic zone, the minister is trying to still revive those benefits and balancing the sensitive nature to the international commitments that actually first caused Namibia to scrap out the EPZ, as it were, because we were blacklisted for that preferential treatment that was accorded to those entities. So yes, the proposed special economic zone tax incentive review, which would allow those entities then to be taxed but rather at a reduced rate similar to the small and medium businesses of 20%, is of course quite welcome. And it is under review and it will possibly then still speak to the intended investment and job creation objectives of government. But another thing that the budget also spoke to, and which possibly is an indirect testament to supporting that the budget may actually be poor, is the proposed introduction of a corporate social responsibility tax deduction. I would say that this measure actually reflects the government's intention to encourage the private sector to participate in social development through the tax system. Businesses would be encouraged to contribute more socially, knowing that whatever contributions they have given would be tax deductible. So that's quite a great incentive in addition to the special economic zone regime that is also being reviewed. Additionally, the minister did announce adjustments to the personal income tax brackets, as she put it, to reduce fiscal drag and improve fairness. This again obviously also speaks to that because it at least would ultimately result in a reduction of the tax brackets to account for inflation and the nominal salary increases that the populace, at least those who are employed, are currently enjoying, so that you don't pay at a higher bracket despite the fact that there's actually no increase in your salary earnings. So I would think that those three announcements by the minister do actually support.
Both of you have touched on the two major policies that the Honorable Minister introduced relating to special economic zones. Salomo touched on the Namibia Investment Promotion and Facilitation Bill. But I see you are shying away from the elephant in the room. We've been here since independence. I want you to speak a bit on the critical part of it, the National Equitable Economic Empowerment Framework. NEEF, a framework relating to the structure of the economy 35 years after independence. Salomo, has anything changed? And is NEEF a good thing or is it a tiger without teeth? Because previous governments have threatened to implement this bill, but have never done, but it is rearing its head again. What do you say?
So look, I mean, 35 years later, if you compare a country to a 35-year-old adult. Ideally, that adult would be a person who's able to take care of themselves and should be a very productive citizen. Now, the Namibian economy in terms of structure has not changed since the 1980s. If you look at what the secondary sector contributes, or the primary sector contributes, and the tertiary sector, it's very similar to what it looked like in the 1980s. Now, what you want for a country that is pre-industrialization, you want it to become bigger within the secondary sector. Essentially, that's the sector where jobs could be created because of the labor absorption capacity of the secondary sector. Now, essentially, with what the minister spoke about, again, with regard to policy certainty, which was encouraging, is that she wants to bring to finality the issues around the Investment Promotion Facilitation Bill, because at the end of the day, you want to have investors know exactly what they are signing up for. Now, as part of the transformation agenda, and specifically perhaps speaking to NEAF, if you look at the pillars that underpin NEAF, the intention is really to look at the economy in its current state and understand perhaps, are there further structural changes that can come as a consequence of a transformation, and transformation through deliberate intervention at a policy level. One of the pillars that NEAF speaks to, I mean, I haven't seen what the current bill reads like, but it wants to empower through ownership, right? And ownership through a means of a scorecard, where you want to bring participation perhaps at an ownership level, and through that have greater expansion. Because essentially what would happen is, if there's a change in ownership, there is currently going to be some level of value exchange, if it were. Value exchange in terms of this transformation would not come in a hostile takeover, if it were, but there's going to be some level of deal flow from an ownership perspective. Now, the general assumption on that would be that perhaps then there's injection of new funds or whatever equity into this business by the previously disadvantaged could potentially lead to expansion, which will then mean that more jobs could potentially be created. I mean, if you look at, again, these sort of initiatives could potentially assist with transforming the economy. And I'm not saying that it will be a perfect transition in terms of this new ownership will be able to immediately transform. But if the intent of the intervention is of such a nature, then there should be steps built towards implementing that. Another one would be entrepreneurship development. Ideally, what you want is you want to be in a position to have cohesion around all of these policies that intend to really deal with the stubborn high unemployment rate through coordinated efforts across the different sectors. Entrepreneurship development, if you are able to mirror that with the youth empowerment, you could potentially move towards redressing the issues around inequality, poverty, and this non-inclusive growth. Now, why do I say non-inclusive growth? I'm saying, if you look at our 35-year GDP cycle, the economy contracted only for 4 of those 35 years, of which 2 of those years were COVID years. So essentially, we don't have a growth problem, if it were, is that our growth is not inclusive. Now, if you again read the budget in terms of what the minister spoke to, and more so what Mercy alluded to in respect of the corporate social responsibility obligations, again, you speak to community investment. Now, community investment would then dictate the corporate social responsibility obligations can dovetail very well with a community investment. But the reality is that it's one thing to speak about a proposed policy. It's another thing to have the policy or this particular act actually becoming a living document. In the absence of it becoming policy, it actually is of no significance. And this is why the minister spoke about the policy clarity and the policy certainty that's required to be able to move the needle on some of the socioeconomic problems and to be able to be clear on how the country intends to move forward. So the long and short of it is that it's critical to make sure that once there's a position to address the issues that have been identified as perhaps bottleneck in bringing about the majority in the economic mainstream, there needs to be sufficient evidence that back up policies and why this particular direction would then look at transforming and changing the current structural patterns that have contributed to the high unemployment. So from where I'm sitting, I think that policy certainty put everyone at ease. You would know that there are countries that are currently in geopolitical tensions, but they still are able to attract investors. So the long and short of it is that Namibia really is one of the countries where you have a very friendly business or investment climate. Obviously, it's not perfect. There are certain bureaucratic issues that hold us back. But in relation to where we want to go, I think we have made very good steps that can assist the country in making sure that it builds its efficiencies. A point in case, Patrick, would be, for instance, the huge outcry around the visa regime, right? And again, the visa regime could have created some level of inconvenience, especially with regard to the system delays and. But we carried out a study a couple of years ago, which actually informed us that when the Schengen visa was introduced in the euro area, it led to an increase in the number of arrivals in that area. So what is the point? The point is, as soon as that certainty around visa regimes are there, whoever wants to come as a tourist to Namibia would have to align themselves with that visa regime. So if the Investment Promotion and Facilitation Bill is prescriptive around Namibianization, local content, and the investors would again be able to know what they are signing up for. If transformation is a policy agenda for the current government and they intend to enact the NIEF, then again, it should be done being underpinned by those principles. So in the absence of, I don't know whether it's a bad policy or no policy, which is detrimental to growth, but at the end of the day, a decision has to be made one way or the other.
I think no policy is better than a bad policy. I venture to say that because the Namibia Institute for Economic Policy say bad policy such as the one in the investment bill and NIEF will discourage investment. But you are saying Namibia does not have a growth problem, an economic structure problem. Is that correct?
Yes. So I was speaking about a document that I have not seen, and also more so a document that I don't know where the basis of that opinion is derived from. But nevertheless, what I'm saying is that if you look at countries where there's some level of political tension, like for instance, in the DRC, where there were problems, you still have investors going in there, right? So my point is that what investors want is certainty. Investors want to know what they are signing up for. We are waiting for the FID on the oil majors. And the reason could be perhaps they want clarity and closure on the petroleum amendment bill, right? They want to know what exactly is going to happen in respect of the mandate of the Ministry of Mines and Energy in relation to the department or division that has been moved under the presidency. So once those are clarified, the investor know what they are signing up for. And remember that the investors don't want to remain mid-air. They either want to land or take off. And if the investment policy or the policy of the specific country speaks to specific outcomes that they intend to achieve and the reason why they are embarking on that, investors are not unreasonable. I've never met an unreasonable investor. Investors are really alive to the different needs and different initiatives that happens in countries and why they take certain positions. I mean, look at Norway. Norway is the model for oil in respect of how they've been able to build one of the biggest sovereign wealth funds globally out of their oil proceeds. And precisely because they were very clear about the local content. And again, if you go to Qatar, they had in Qatar what they referred to as the Qatarization of the sector. And I think there were seven principles that underpinned that. So my point is that the policy or the investment decisions need to be certain so that investors know exactly what they are signing up for. Because if the investor is ready to invest in Namibia, he wants to know what are his potential rate of return, as opposed to being told tomorrow that, no, because you have invested, now we're going to do this. So they want to have that certainty. And this is all investors want. And investors are alive to the different needs of different countries. And like I said, I don't think that investors are unreasonable.
Very well. Mercy, any word from you relating to VAT manual, to e-filing and the coming to an end of tax amnesty? Is that a good thing? Are those helpful?
Look, the tax amnesty has been in place now for at least, and I'm speaking under correction, for at least for the last 3 to 4 years. And it has allowed taxpayers, once you pay the capital outstanding, then the penalties and interest would be waived. So it was a way to encourage taxpayers to regularize their tax affairs and also just for revenue to actually collect on the outstanding taxes at the time. So it was supposed to have come to an end already. It was extended, and now it was announced that this extension will be the last one. It will be coming to an end in October 2026. It is still ample time for taxpayers who still have outstanding tax issues to actually participate in the amnesty and try and make sure that before that cutoff date, they have regularized their tax affairs. And it applies both to tax and VAT. On the VAT part, the minister did announce that the VAT legislation would be bolstered and amended to bolster certain key sectors. Specific mention was made to the agricultural sector as it relates to input imports. This is possibly the machinery and all other products that the sector does import and how those would be treated. Again, it was not expanded on how those amendments to the Act would actually look like. But the other thing with respect to VAT that the minister also announced on was to modernize the VAT Act and implement e-invoicing to improve legislative clarity and also just to enhance compliance and reduce fraud. So both of those would be welcome amendments for both the taxpayers and for the fiscus. The other thing, maybe from an administrative perspective, that the minister also announced was to try and reduce the turnaround time of refunds to between 30 and 60 days. Currently taxpayers do wait quite prolonged periods to get their refunds. And this at least is a way that NAMRA would be committed to trying to process refunds faster than they do currently and to have taxpayers refunded within at least a proposed shorter period than what currently is the case.
Any last word from you, Mr. Hay?
So I think Namibia is at a point where it has never been before in terms of the potential that we offer to the world because of the environment that was created over the years. It's really a place where we are attracting a lot of FDIs. If you look at our FDI over the past 3 years, it's commendable. I think we have the biggest attraction for greenfields on the continent. We must now be able to turn this potential into a real dividend. And we can only do that provided that we are firm in terms of what it is that we want to achieve and really making sure that we build a strong and able policy framework that will be able to encourage investment from the private sector and attract further investment because of the certainty that will come. The budget was fair given the declining revenue bars that Namibia had, but over and above that, I think it was a budget that was given under difficult circumstances, and we hope that some of those policy initiatives now get concluded so that we can start bring about the inclusive growth that Namibia so urgently needs.
Any last word from you, Mercy?
From a tax perspective, I think most of what was announced in the budget is quite welcome. We actually look forward to just see what kind of the format it would take because most of it was just bullet points. We can't speak much to the regime that would be introduced by those proposals, but all of those are actually quite welcome.
Very well. Thank you for joining us for another CDH Conversation podcast.
The views and information expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily present those of the firm. All content is provided for general purposes only and does not constitute legal advice. We make no representations, warranties, or guarantees, whether expressed or implied, that the content on our podcast is accurate, complete, up-to-date, or reflects the current law. We accept no responsibility for any loss or damage, whether direct or consequential, arising from reliance on the information which is presented here.